Nothing in this program should be considered investment advice. It is for educational purposes only. Please hit pause and read this disclaimer in full.
We're back to running $1 trillion deficits every 100 days now. Remember, we complained about that so much last year in the prior administration. So it seems like the only thing they know to do is just spend us into oblivion and hope it all works out.
The following is the audio version of a video released at peakprosperity.com. Visit peakprosperity.com to watch the video and to find other insightful content such as articles, discussion forums, and exclusive subscriber-only content.
Hello, everybody. Welcome to this episode of Finance U. I'm your host, Dr. Chris Martins, and it's August. We're in the doldrums of August, but we've got some really important stuff to talk to you about today. We're going to be looking at just, well, how super-duper crazy these markets are right now, but it's a tale of two worlds. There's a headline number, what's lurking beneath the surface, some things to be cautious about there, and then we're going to talk about the recession indicators that are now flashing bright red. So, Paul, really looking forward to having this conversation today.
Me too. Lots to talk about, and happy dog days. We're officially in the dog days, right? So
yes.
So happy doldrums.
Yeah. Happy doldrums. Yeah, sure. Well, I mean, I get it. You know, people shouldn't have to pay attention. We should all get a month off. I think Europe's got August right. But still, something's going on right now. We got to talk about some of them. So super duper nuts. We talked about how nuts the markets were last time, so I had to put a super duper in front of it this time. So here's something I came across, which is, this is a historical trend line, and so this is on a log chart, so a straight line count means it's growing logarithmically, right? And it starts in 1870, comes through to current, and I think what's immediately obvious is that it spends, you know, some time above the trend, and a little bit of time below the trend, and above the trend, and below the trend. This is the great, you know, market crash of... This is the whole Great Depression era right here, right? And then it goes back above trend here, and we got our nifty 50s, and we're below trend. This is one of the longest, biggest departures. It's now, actually, as of today, re-adding this, I think it's at 173%. Way above trend, never been this high off of trend, never been this far away from trend. Latest price, there it is, yeah, 173% above trend. We're way off a trend. So that means that, Paul, we have to account for the idea that compared to at any other time in our history, things are just so spectacularly good now that this is justified. And I think this did a good job capturing just how much nuts we got going on right now. Super duper nuts.
Well, I love that chart. One, it shows the cyclicality that we go through these emotional cycles throughout history, but it also highlights the fact, what's different this time, right? The government's just printed and printed and printed. Debt hasn't mattered. You know, people thought that debt didn't matter before 1929. Mm-hmm. It was consumer debt, but obviously the government's taking it on this time. And what, we're back to running $1 trillion deficits every 100 days now. Remember, we complained about that so much last year in the prior administration. So it seems like the only thing they know to do is just spend us into oblivion and hope it all works out. But I don't believe this is going to end any differently, quite frankly.
No, it never does. And so my purpose here today is I just want to caution people, because it's easy to get sucked into these things, particularly at the end. And by the way, Wall Street's job is specifically to suck in as many retail people right at the end. They know what the score is. They know that this things come, things go, breathe in, breathe out, things go up, things go down. And of course, they've had an activist interventionist Fed who's also been interested in seeing number go up. And so they've had that. But this is how crazy it is right now. So technology, we can all admit, oh, yeah, Paul, that was silly back there in the .com. Mistakes were made. But this time is different. Look at this massive peak right here. And by the way, this is the sell-off that took us into October of 23, where something happened. You and I talked about it extensively. Mm-hmm. I think somebody threw a lot of money into the markets from somewhere because they didn't want that to correct for whatever reason. And here we are. So this is NASDAQ market cap. It's now more than 105% of U.S. GDP.
That's incredible. I've not seen that chart. That is absolutely incredible. Wow.
Yeah. What do you say about something like that?
Well, You know, here's the thing. There's a lot of people out there that are going to say, just because you're warning people about what's taking place right now, oh, you're a perma bear, you're whatever. But if you're not paying attention to risk in the markets, then you're not an investor, you're a gambler. Mm-hmm. And this is something that's ridiculously important. It's going to matter because you look at all of that historical period of time just since 1990. It was held there briefly in the year 2000, but AI is much more disruptive than internet connecting us all together around the world and making globalization a lot easier and global business easier. So I don't think it's different this time. The question is, there's a tremendous amount of euphoria. There's no fear with your average market participant. And even though people have learned enough from the past to not say out loud that it's different this time, they're behaving like it's absolutely different this time.
Well, let's talk about what's not different. By the way, I was just interviewed yesterday by George Gammon on his show, and I was really gratified because he totally led off with and understood that energy is the economy, and that he clearly, at my talk at Limitless, he was gobsmacked because he didn't know just how much energy AI was gobbling and how much water it was gobbling, and that we're not having any sort of national discussion about that. And then you just see these charts thrown out there that says, oh, well, AI is going to go from 5% of current electricity consumption in the U.S. to closer to 12% in the next few years. It's like, where is that coming from? Well, I'll tell you where it's coming from. Out of your higher electricity bills. That's where it's coming from.
Yes.
Guaranteed.
Hey, I cannot wait. I'll have to seek out and listen to that interview with you and George, because he was sitting over from me and I looked and he was absolutely glued to you through the whole presentation. I mean, your presentation was absolutely stunning.
Thanks. Yeah. No, it's just logical stuff, right? You know, A plus B and you get to C. Another way to look at this too is this is tech versus the S&P 500 as a total thing. And so that's the relative price. At any rate, tech is now at almost about 2.2 compared to, these are standard deviations. This is more than two standard deviations. It touched it once in January of 1970, touched it again in February of the double aughts, 2000, just blew, touched it here. This is, I think there should have been a correction here. That was fought tooth and nail. The Fed said, not on our watch. They printed up a bunch of money, threw it in the markets, and here we are. I just don't know what the plan is. Like, do we double from, I mean, where do we go from here, you know?
At best that we can hope for at this point, Chris, and in my opinion, is let's say that two standard deviations was a resistance level and we've broken through that. At best, we can hope that in pullbacks, we hold that level. And I don't think that's going to happen when you look at it. At all cycles throughout history, but that's the best that we can hope for at this point, because it's clear that you're going to have steps forward, steps back. There has been a resistance level. And I think it's just a testament to the fact that we're in peak euphoria and peak gambling right now.
Well, you know, one of the stumper questions that I George didn't have a great answer for this either, which is, listen, not my first rodeo. I remember the internet bubbles. It was eyeballs. And then you couldn't possibly put in enough fiber. It was all going to be lit. Turned out it stayed dark for a decade and, you know, Cisco got crushed. There were stories, right? Well, this mm-hmm. time it's the same thing. We have this story. AI is going to transform, disrupt, whatever your language is. But I keep asking this question, but how does it make money for the people? Like there are data centers, Paul, that got built 2 years ago. They're kind of already going to have to get refurbished. Like it has a very short shelf life. From a technology standpoint, because, you know, your chips are old and they consume way too much power and they won't perform the tasks you need or whatever the story is. So you got to refresh all that. Who's making money on this stuff? Besides the people installing all that stuff, I get that, right? Selling all the equipment, right?
I don't know. I mean, I see people using it for business ideas. I know that it's made me more efficient in some of the mathematical calculations that are out there. So it saved me more time. But has it necessarily been profitable at this point? I don't know. I haven't seen it out there yet. Now, apparently there are some AI trading algorithms that are out there that are making money for people. And maybe it's making corporations more efficient. But as far as pure profitability at this point, I mean, I've not seen anybody report on that at all. Have you?
Not yet. I mean, I'm waiting for it. But I'm just keeping an eye out for it because, you know, there's always the promise at the beginning, but then eventually it has to make money. right? So there was a lot of things in the digital currency space where they said, oh, this is going to disrupt all these use cases. They were great stories, right? Smart contracts were going to be used for everything. And I understood the story and it made sense, but I haven't seen the implementation at all, practically, let alone keep up with the promises. And eventually, at some point, you just have to go, maybe that wasn't a real thing. Because here's my belief, Paul. If a technology is really good, it doesn't need subsidies, nobody has to enforce it, doesn't have to be mandated, people just use it, and right. off it goes, you know?
Right. Well, and the other side of that, let's say for the major law firms that are laying off, or Microsoft's laid off all these coders and these attorneys, obviously that's helping their profitability. But on the other side, the U.S. economy is heavily reliant upon the consumer. So if you're eating these jobs away, then at some point people are going to have less to spend to be able to recycle back into those profits. And ultimately that ends up being deflationary, not inflationary.
Well, I don't think anybody's thinking about that at sort of the Henry Ford level. Like, you pay your workers $5 a day? He's like, yeah, so they can buy my cars, right? That's right. How this works, you know?
Right.
So one other thing, which I know you're going to love, remember when we were kvetching about the Buffett indicator being at 208%? Well, it's 212 now.
Yeah.
We're in bright red territory. It, you know, moving from fairly valued to modestly overvalued, we're into significantly overvalued is the term they're using here. And by the way, Buffett, for his part, just keeps stacking cash.
Yes, he does.
Just keeps stacking it.
He sure does.
The other part I wanted to talk about with this is that I think a lot of what's driving this. So M2 is a measure of money. We don't have M3 to work with anymore. But M2, for those listening, M1 is currency and coins. You would recognize that stuff. It's the literal cash and some other things that play just like literal cash. M2 is a little bit more broad. You have to peer into the banking system, and this would include money market funds and time deposits like CDs. But anything that sort of looks like money, you add it up, and it's been growing again. And this is confusing to me, Paul, because the way you get more M2 in the system is by banks making loans.
Mm-hmm.
And I haven't seen super strong loan stuff, but, you know, I talked last week that, yes, consumers took on another $180 billion in credit. So anytime credit's extended, this number goes up, you know, roughly speaking. So I think this is driving a lot of behaviors here. We talked about how there was that big correction that they had to, you know, get done. But if you take this little blip away, this is a very smooth exponential curve, just going up and up and up and up. And so that's the money system we have. But you know what some of that, you know what some of those loans are for, Paul? We've talked about margin debt. So isn't this fun? So you get loans, drives M2 up, that makes stocks go up, which drives loans to people who want to get into the stock market, which drives M2 up. There's a little bit of a circular thing going on here, I think. That's a lot of money right there. That's a, you know, we looked at M2 expanding by a trillion plus. Well, you know, there's 400 billion of it right there.
Yeah, look at the most recent spike right there. Like, it's near panic loaning to either purchase securities or whatever else they're purchasing on those margin.
Yeah, and also investor psychology. I have to, you know, like, listen, when things are super duper nuts, people are basically speculating. Did you see this? This is insanity, Zero Hedge writes. The retail 0 days to expiration, the ODTE option trading, is about to hit 2/3 of all daily option volumes. The market is literally a casino now.
No, I have not. I've seen some other data as far as what retail's doing, but I did not see that. That's
two-thirds.
Well said. 2/3. That's incredible. Well, hey, bull markets, when the market just continues to go up and all policy makers are flipping on a dime, you know, it just continues to fuel the confidence because, you know, bull markets make everybody feel like geniuses until the cycle turns, and it feeds on itself, right? That's one of those things. Oh, I did this and it worked out. Oh, I did this and it worked out. Oh, now I'm a genius, so I'm going to get more aggressive and more aggressive and more aggressive. And that's just a sign that there is no caution in the average retail investor right now. Another sign.
Yeah.
There's plenty of them.
Well, I mean, this is pretty simple. Stocks go up when there are more buyers than sellers. And they go down when there are more sellers than buyers. This whole idea that there's cash in the sidelines, I think John Hussman disabused me of that idea 15 years ago. He said, there's no money in the markets, right? If I buy a stock with cash on the sidelines, I give it to you, Paul, because you sold it to me. Well, now you have the cash on the sideline. Exact same amount of cash was on the sidelines before and after. So we can dispense with cash on the sidelines. What matters is buying pressure. Are more people are more buyers coming in than are leaving, you know? And that's the whole dynamic. People want to buy right now. So,
right. Well, I think retail wants to buy. And I think a lot of your professional investors are having to buy to keep their jobs. Because if you're not chasing the top 10 and you're not speaking to an audience that's aware, like those that are following you, of just how distorted and how risky this environment is, then you have to panic buy. That momentum's feeding the momentum. It's another indicator. I don't know if you've seen, I can delete some of the things that I had here, but let me find it real quick. I want to show the difference in the performance between Buffett and Berkshire Hathaway. So just Dario put this out. Fun fact, Warren Buffett always tends to underperform indexes significantly before the bubble pops. So, and he highlighted Vlad the Inflator. But if you take a look at this chart, Berkshire's dramatically trailed the S&P 500 since May. Okay, look at the periods of time that he did that. Depths of the COVID pandemic, depths of the global financial crisis, and the dot-com bubble. Because he's a disciplined investor. So that's just another mile marker going along with, you know, his record pile of cash. So $347 billion in cash, nearly 30% of Berkshire Hathaway's. This is the largest cash pile in U.S. corporate history. When you take that into consideration with what's going on out there, he's sticking to his strategy and staying fundamentally focused and not speculating. He's an investor, not a speculator. But there's a lot of investors out there. There's a lot of market participants that are speculators, and they don't even realize they're speculators. They really believe they're investors because they're listening to the financial media that's trying to push these products off of them and provide exits. I mean, another clear road marker that we had, and we've talked about this before, is private equity has this massive marketing campaign to bring in the average individual right now. Mm-hmm. And then, of course, there's no telling how much money they spent and the influence they pulled to get into Trump's ear to open up 401ks to private equity at this point in the cycle. Like, that's the perfect exit opportunity because the returns look great. Most investors don't know how to quantify an investment, so they look at the past performance and they go, wow, if I'd have just done that, and then they invest into it, usually at the worst part of the cycle, when they should be looking at other areas. And I've got some charts to show the opposite of the NASDAQ here in a minute that go along with energy. But Buffett, that's one reason I respect him a lot. You know, I go back and look at all these rolling historical periods. The single best period that you could have started investing or opened the funds, 1973, 1974, throughout all rolling historical periods up until today. So yes, the wind was at his sails. But you go back and look at how he's navigated so clearly and tends to underperform right before the bubbles pop. And I don't think it's any different this time.
I don't think so either. And Paul, when we come back, we're going to talk about these recession indicators. I think everybody should listen to that. Hang on, everybody. We'll be right back. The markets are a ticking time bomb. Volatility is spiking, trade wars have broken out, and most investors are sleepwalking into disaster. Many portfolio strategies perform poorly during times like these. At Peak Financial Investing, however, we don't gamble with your future. Our registered investment advisory connects you with battle-tested wealth managers who reject outdated models and embrace active management, strategies proven to navigate chaos, and who aren't afraid to discuss things like the great taking or maybe the importance of protecting your wealth with gold. Without the right approach and with the wrong advisor, you're risking, well, everything. Don't wait for the crash to act. Visit peakfinancialinvesting.com right now to schedule a free consultation and discuss your particular situation. Take control of your wealth before the markets take it from you. Again, that's peakfinancialinvesting.com, and I'm Dr. Chris Martinson urging you to act now. Welcome back, everybody. We're going to continue our conversation. Paul, I've got a bunch of recession indicators. You said you had a couple of charts you wanted to show first.
So while it's fresh on everybody's mind, when you were talking about NASDAQ in relation to U.S. equity, let's go take a look at some of these others. And this is in line with kind of your energy talk that's out there. So the chart of energy stocks relative to the S&P 500 looks very similar. Notice we're lower than we were in 1999. Okay, ooh, so this is energy stocks relative to the S&P 500. This is the exact opposite picture of what we're seeing with technology stocks in relation to the S&P 500. You know, that's an area that's ridiculously undervalued, and you have all kind of data to show the long-term picture there. And let me see if this is the next one. So that was energy. Looks like I duplicated that one. That's it. I had another one that showed commodity stocks in relation to the S&P 500, but it's pretty much the same chart. Like, they are so ridiculously undervalued or underweighted as a position of the S&P 500. And if you go back to 1999, I'll share one other chart in here just to reference this. And this is one thing that I've shown several times before, but I think it's something that investors need to be aware of and pay attention to. So if we go back to 1990s really is what I'm going to reference here. And so that's 2008 till today. Now, I don't have the data daily for commodities in here, but it's not much different. This is 1990 to the year 2000. The black line is the S&P 500. You showed from a technology standpoint, that was the internet bubble, that it was, you know, we've broken the peak that occurred back in 1999, 2000. Well, if we go take a look at what happened from 2000 to 2007, in the following period of time, when we go back, this is just commodities in general. Look at how well commodities perform going forward, because when reality set in, investors stopped chasing eyeballs, you know, when they were counting eyeballs there, and the reality of the internet, yes, it was revolutionary, but not as quick in the manner as investors thought, and then they started scrambling back to energy, commodities, emerging markets. All of those value stocks did really good for the following years. So I just like to highlight this again. Now, I'm not a prediction of what's going to happen in the future. We don't know how much longer this is going to last. But if you go take a look at those same sectors since January 1st, 2008 till today, I mean, the Goldman Sachs Commodity Index is still 12% below what it was January 1st of 2008. And you can see it started to come to life there. And then again, whatever changed back in 2023, we get back into this chasing the top 10 stocks and selling everything else. Emerging markets are trying to pop up a little bit. Developed markets are trying to pop up a little bit. But for the patient investor, this is a period of time when you look at all of these distortions economically that you should be contrarian. Okay, I'm not a believer that you should be contrarian all of the time, but at the extremes, you should be contrarian. So, you know, that just highlights the opportunity that's out there for those investors that choose not to gamble and speculate. You know, if you want to gamble, go to Vegas. At least you know your odds, right? And be happy if you win something. But in the markets, don't be speculating with your hard-earned savings, especially if you're at or in retirement. Because look, this is my 27th year of doing this, 27 years now. And by God's grace, our strategy worked. We've not had anybody wiped out on our watch because we're designed to lower risk. But I have seen people absolutely wiped out in retirement and their lives upended and the emotional damage that causes. But here's the thing. Very few people hear those stories unless you're in the industry or unless you're really close to somebody, because people are quick to share the good things. Because it makes them feel smart. It makes them feel good. Hey, you know, the Lord just blessed me in this circumstance. I hear that all the time. But people don't go out and say, yeah, you know, rarely do they, unless they're trying to warn others of their own mistakes, to help protect other people as a watchman. But few people go out and say, hey, you know, I absolutely got wiped out. They kind of just drift away from their circles. They drift away from society. They can't take the trips with people that they did before. They don't get to play golf or do their hobbies like they did. They just kind of disappear from society. I can't warn people enough. This is not a time to speculate. This is a time to be careful. and to operate under proven investment strategies and be patient. Because look, I've been highlighting the history of bubbles again here for a while, because I do believe that we're in the midst of one. And the one thing that's common about bubbles, you never know when they end. They're going to last longer than you think that they're going to, and they're going to come apart much faster than you think that they will. You think that you're going to be able to exit, but if you don't have a plan, it's going to be very hard, because of the same analogy we used last week, you know, the Lucent technology, it drops. Well, I'll sell it when it gets here, and then it drops again. And before you know it, your wealth is wiped out. And at the worst point, you're tempted to throw the baby out with the bathwater, just like all of the other investors who got caught up in the emotional boom. They get caught up in the emotional doom as well.
Yeah. Well, you know, it's never over till the fat lady sings. And by the way, there are a lot of people out there, Trump included, saying, oh, we want a rate cut. And so I think the expectations are that the Fed's going to cut 0.5 in September. Okay, it's coming up soon. If they do, Paul, all the charts I have say that when the Fed finally starts cutting rates, it's already over, right? And so I do want to talk about some of these recession indicators, because I think it's going to be, even a rate cut can't do anything about these things at this point. We're too far gone. But I did see, because you had a bunch of tabs up there, and there was one with, I just flashed by, but if it's the one I'm thinking of, we must have seen the same tweet. It's Jerome Powell in a cockpit, and yes, and they're asking the questions like, a rate cut, right? I love that series of data points, and they said, how does this sum up to a rate cut decision, you know, besides political pressure?
Well, I had somebody jump on me in town the other day, said, I can't believe that you're not for rate cuts. And then, of course, Charlie Bellello puts this out there great.
That's the one.
Yeah. Stocks at an all-time high. Home prices at an all-time high, Bitcoin all-time high, gold at an all-time high, and I don't want to go through this too fast because we got to get it. Money supplies at an all-time high. You just showed that with M2.
Yep.
National debt at an all-time high and increasing at $1 trillion every 100 days again.
Yep.
CPI inflation, it came in as expected, 4% per year since January 2020, two times the Fed's target. And the Fed cutting interest rates next month. And for those of you that can't see, you know, this is Jerome Powell. I would assume that's a helicopter. Well, that's not a helicopter, a jet. But look at all the dollars flying right behind him. That's all we're doing right now.
Yeah.
Right? I mean, that's literally all we're doing. And it's ridiculous. Absolutely ridiculous.
Yep.
And then you have Scott Bessent comes out. Let me see the quote here. Treasury Secretary Scott Bessent told Bloomberg TV that rates should likely be 1.5 to 1.75% lower. And quote, we could go into a series of rate cuts here, starting with a 50 basis point rate cut in September. End quote.
Can you imagine if you're interviewing for the next Treasury, I'm sorry, for the next Fed chairmanship, because, you know, that's what they're doing. And by the way, I saw a headline that almost I threw up into my mouth a little bit, where they were, Scott Bessent said, well, we were considering, one of the people we're considering is Janet Yellen.
Are you serious?
Totally serious.
Oh my gosh. Oh, I'm blown away by that.
Wow. She was a disaster in that position. As far as I'm concerned, monetary vandalism was committed, and here we are. But she's the kind of gal they might like, right? She's a political animal, and she'll just do whatever it takes to keep the punch going. And I think that's what Trump wants. He wants stocks to go up. He just wants things to go up. Now, all those other things lurking under there, which is, look, you know, we've been cataloging this for a while, Paul. People, higher and higher up the socioeconomic chain, are starting to squeal a little bit because insurance costs are through the roof. You know, food costs obviously haven't come down. They've moderated in terms of how fast they're going up, but they're still going up. You know, it's just everything's wicked expensive right now, you know, and we're going to cut rates for what? To stimulate what? Right. And so I think this is a dangerous time. I think when the Fed starts cutting rates, I actually think that's when the wheels come off, not when things finally get even more shiny.
Well, and I've been thinking about this the last couple of days, and I don't know how the outcome is, but Samantha Leduc posted a tweet when they first started raising interest rates. She said, this is counterintuitive, but higher interest rates are inflationary. because you've got large amounts of cash. Corporate had locked in lower rates. They've got all these treasuries they're sitting on. Money market rates were real high, and that's generating income that's being paid back into society. Well, when we look back, it's obviously been asset price inflationary, so I'm not so sure that cutting rates is going to have the inflationary impact that they believe that it will. But at the same time, on the other side of that, look, you know, Trump came in and he's like, it's time for Main Street to participate. Wall Street's had their day. Well, if it has the same impact that it did historically, how are any of our kids going to be able to afford homes in the future? I mean, is this just a part of the plan? It's 2030 and you're going to own nothing and you're going to be happy? I mean, is everybody just going to be happy because nobody owns anything in the top 5% do? I mean, we're seeing that in the markets right now. You look at the S&P 490, they've essentially had flat earnings in spite of higher inflation, you know, for the past 3 to 4 years. It's just your top 10 stocks that are garnering up all of the revenue right now. And I'm so ridiculously disappointed. And you know, I mean, look, I'm happy about there are some things, and I'm not getting political. I'm just calling as it is. I'm very disappointed that we're back to the same thing that's put us into the problems that we have societally here now. And, you know, there was a recent survey. I have the tweet in here somewhere. I couldn't find it. I was trying just then. They surveyed individuals making $50,000 a year and asked them what their income would need to be to feel comfortable. And they said $125,000. Mm-hmm. And then they interviewed the people. Yeah, they interviewed the people that were making $100,000 a year and asked them, you know, what income they would need to feel comfortable. And it's 200 and something. I want to say 275,000. Let's just say 250. And I hope I'm underestimating a little bit. But that's every sector of society is feeling these pressures right now. Suicide rates are higher. Drug rates are higher. Addiction rates are higher. And that's all demoralization because mm-hmm. they've not allowed these economic cycles to occur. What we need is we need a recession, actually. And look, I'm sorry, if you're over-levered to the hill and it wipes you out, you should have known what you were doing, okay? Any time that you make a decision, you over-lever yourself, if there's somebody out there, use this opportunity to get out of that weak position, because you've got to be in a position to stand the test of time. And the longer we put off, who knows how long it lasts? It doesn't matter. It's not going to end any different. The longer they put this off, the worse the pain's going to be on the other side, and the fewer people are going to be able to hide.
Yeah, I agree. And by the way, anybody who, you know, if you're a business owner and or, you know, you've got a portfolio, you have to start thinking about the risk of this, because recessions happen. You can paper them over a little bit. I don't think we have the political willpower right now. Like COVID, they papered over a bad one, but they sent people stimmy checks, like trillions of dollars were just sort of cut. You know, you had Congress people taking PPP loans that they knew they weren't going to have to pay back. And that anyway, water under the bridge. But I don't think we have that capability. And I see a recession, which they happen. The last one got put off. The last one before that even got put off. So I think there's a lot of deadwood on the forest floor. This could be a ripper if it gets going. But I want to talk about these recession indicators. So forewarned is forearmed, but if you are over-leveraged in some way, shape, or form, or stretching, you might want to consider dialing that back. So we have the package indicator, UPS. Look at this, Paul. Like, here's the whole COVID bump. It's falling off as if, like, it's getting back to 2008 levels here again, as Darth Powell says here, Vlad the Inflator. Yeah, it's got like a... But that's a really big, it's below where it was even before COVID happened. Like, so obviously UPS, important indicator. When people are in non-recessionary moods, they buy things and then those get shipped, and that's shows up in the UPS's profit line. Got that. How about the labor indicator? So this is for youth, young adults in America, 16 to 24, but you can see, look at this, Paul, 17-18% youth unemployment.
Wow.
And every time that's ticked up, we've had a recession in there, right? And this is, again, COVID is this weird anomaly. I don't know if we should consider it in the data series, but this is the 2001 recession. This is the GFC here, Great Financial Crisis, and here we are. So is that AI? Is it? It's not a strong thing, but I think it's a flashing red indicator. And here we have the Kansas City Fed labor market conditions, which applies to everybody. And so this is a level of activity indicator. Below zero would be going into negative territory. This, I'm going to say, is orange. Red is anything below the zero line. Every time you're below that zero line, you've got a nice fat recession on your hands. But we're clearly headed that way. So keep an eye on that.
And look at that right at the end of your box there. You had a nice little spike that occurred, and that was immediately erased in newer lows that were set in that short-term period in that red box. So, I mean, you know, look, clearly things are weakening, not as fast as what everybody was anticipating, but they're clearly continuing to weaken.
Yep. Unusual whales posting here, U.S. spending on services. That's hotels, airfare, dining, down three straight months, first time since 2008, per Bank of America. This is a very key indicator for me, Paul, because this is sort of the discretionary side of things. People taking trips, eating out, going to hotels. Those are some of the first things that do get dialed back on right away.
Well, I already know of 8 to 10 individuals that have canceled their future travel plans in the next year, because of their insurance, their property and casualty insurance costs, their car insurance costs, and their property taxes. Yes. It ate up their entire travel budget and their retirement plan. So they're just making some adaptations right now. Yes.
Well, that's a big deal. And you and I both know somebody who's at a pretty swanky resort in the Dominican Republic, saying it was hard to get in there, you know, kind of hard. And he reported back this morning that the place is a ghost town. That the guests are outnumbered by the staff right now. And normally this place is packed wall to wall. So when recessions happen, Paul, it's like that silent dog whistle that only the consumers can hear. You know, the economists can't hear it. Politicians are tone deaf. But people just know, and the vibe, and it spreads quick. You notice when you go through a half-empty airport just a couple of months ago, it was like a nightmare to get through security.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah.
Here's a fast food indicator, Cava, that is sort of swanky fast food, 22% plunge after missing earnings. So so we see Chipotle, Wendy's, Noodles, Sweetgreen. Anyway, they're all well off their highs now. So fast food's an indicator to me, Paul. I would expect fast food to die off faster, earlier than in-service dining places, you know, Cheesecake Factories, et cetera, just because these are the people who are eating here are going to be more price sensitive, more recession sensitive, right? This is where you expect to see it.
I'm curious. So it's been so long because since Holly and I did the carnivore thing, you know, after your education, Dr. Ken Berry, we've been really clean eating and haven't eaten out as much as what we did or even fast food at all. But one of the things that I've noticed historically is those fast food restaurants are typically cheaper than going and cooking from scratch at home. Is that still the case, do you know?
No, I don't think so. They're really expensive now.
Yeah. So, but yeah, I mean, that's a major indicator right there for sure.
Yeah. But, Paul, none of those indicators matter compared to this one. This is the most potent indicator there is. The stripper indicator. Bright red. RCI Hospitality Holdings, which is Rick on the NASDAQ, operates all these gentlemen clubs, adult cabaret, Foxy's, you know, strip clubs. Also, the company also owns and operates restaurants and sports bars. When men stop spending on beer and sports and trips to the strip club, also a very sensitive indicator. I'm only half joking about this one. This one's actually, everybody should have their eye on this one. So they didn't just miss. Consensus estimate of earning $1.24. And they came in at 77 cents, so they missed by 38%.
That's a huge miss.
Yeah. And it's a 43% decline over the earnings same period last year. So
Wow.
Yep.
I've never followed that indicator. I'll have to start keeping up with it.
Rick is a good one. And then, you know, the Conference Board does their leading economic index, the LEI. Drawdown now is 17.8% as of their July reading. I haven't got their August reading yet. It comes out once a month. And so in June, which is being reported in July, it was a 4% year-over-year decline. It basically in 2008 territory again. Well, we've exceeded even this COVID blip that happened down here. So it's hemorrhaging away. So those things to me collectively say that, you know, we have a pretty strong sense. We got labor, consumers out, the marginal things that are most sensitive at the edge of the consumer experience, which is travel, discretionary, strip clubs, and Vegas. I didn't put Vegas in here, but their foot traffic is way off. So those are all indicators that just say, yeah, this could be a recession.
That's interesting. And I noticed that chart was far worse than the 2000 to 2003 recession, where the S&P had a 47% decline and the NASDAQ was close to 80, if I remember correctly.
Construction spending is down a lot.
Yeah.
But it's a tale of two worlds because office spending is down a lot. But guess what? Data center construction's up a bunch. I think it's just softened by it. But construction spending is a big deal here.
It is a big deal.
So when you said, you know, the 490 in the S&P, those are the companies that are all highly sensitive to this recession thing. And we have to believe that those top 10 are going to be immune to that. Maybe they're getting government revenues. You know, that's part of their, who knows what's happening there. But those 490 are going to be absolutely, you know, well, and they've been weak for a while, though, haven't they? Value stocks. And like when you look at the earnings profile underneath the top 10, it's been pretty weak for a while. That would actually fit with the data I just showed, wouldn't it?
It have, and I actually found that graph. So let me pull that up so I can share it
with you. Yeah, let's take a look.
So that was Michael Arrowitt.
Yep.
I'm sure I butchered the name. But S&P 490 has had basically no earnings growth since 2022. Despite rampant inflation, it's just 10 companies doing really well while the broader economy is in contraction in real terms. So if you look at this, I mean, and this is why, you know, if you're properly diversified or if you're running a value strategy or you're running any fundamental overlay in your investment approach, you're going to be struggling some. You're probably doing okay, but you're going to be struggling some if your only benchmark is going to be the top 10 across the board. But look at that. I mean, that's essentially no growth since June of 2022, but your top 10 stocks are garnering up all of the revenue. I mean, that's impactful. And so are we in a circumstance now where these 10 stocks are strong enough and will continue to be strong enough to keep these markets up regardless of what happens under the surface or economically? That's a heck of a bet to make. That's a heck of a bet to make.
Oh, nobody would make that bet, Paul. Nifty 50. Have people made that bet before?
Nifty50.com bubble. Let's see. What else is it? There was another.
In that list of things for justifying the rate cut, I will note this is core CPI. And this was the sort of the surprise was core CPI ticked back up. Everybody thought it was just going to keep trundling down, but it did tick back up. And, you know, core is ex food and energy. And so this is the one that the Fed is supposed to be looking at. And they said they had a 2% target. So we're 50% above that 2% target. And they're talking about cutting. So they're playing with fire here. They know it. We all know it. You know, if inflation gets out of control here, it's really going to hurt a lot of people. And by the way, the CPI itself, as we all know, is complete junk. You had read that list by Charlie Bilello. I got one more from him here. The most absurd number in the CPI, he asks, according to the U.S. government, the cost of health insurance has declined by 19% over the last 5 years.
An outright lie.
Absolute 100% fiction. And of course, they do it with creative accounting and creative statistics. And the way they do this, I was surprised, Paul. I would have thought you just go, like, you can just go to these health portals and just look at the plans. And all you'd have to do is look at the plans. And then the BLS is often very good at doing hedonic substitution adjustments and things like that when they want to, right? Oh, the car is so much better. It's as if it got cheaper. But the reverse of that, there ought to be reverse hedonics, right? Because the health plans are getting worse. Higher deductibles, more exclusions, less things it will cover, smaller in-network, you know, areas you could go to, like just erosion on all that. So they ought to be getting hedonically maladjusted. And they don't do that. You know what they do? They look at the profitability of these big health insurers, and they use that as a surrogate for how much the premiums must have been.
Seriously.
It's the most arcane, bizarre, stupid thing you could ever imagine. And then you get this stupid chart. I can tell you over the last 5 years, every single year for the last 5 years, because I have to buy a plan that's had my children on it, And as they've aged out, I'm just down to one now. But but that has gone up by, not including how bad the plans have gotten. I'm at the bronze level, like, and it just gets worse and worse. What's excluded and all that, and deductibles, but keep going up. It's gone up minimum. The smallest increase I ever had was 11%, but it's been high double digits every single one of those years. 15, 18% is a pretty typical year for that.
Amazing.
So it's a lie. Anyway.
Yeah. It's a complete lie.
Yeah. Infuriating, kind of.
It really is. Because look, I mean, everybody sees it. Holly's a teacher, Georgia school system. So, you know, I always laugh when they send her out her her information. This is your equivalent pay because we're covering the large majority of your insurance. Now, granted, it's a huge benefit, but our deductibles have gone up every year. Like you said, network is reduced. You get poorer and poorer service, and everybody's paying more and more and more. It's just not honest. And everybody can see it. It's reaching the point where everybody can see it now.
Yeah. Well, Paul, I think they should hire that BLS lady back so they can fire her again for this travesty. You know?
Well said.
Hey, I'm sure you saw this too, but so you mentioned a little bit of disappointment. I was so excited when Trump first got in for his, what I thought were going to be these finally rational government policies. Doge, huge fan, find wasteful spending, you know, put bullets in that. I'm sure there were other efficiencies. You and I both know that during COVID, government spending jumped by $2 trillion. I thought, well, can you get half of that back? Seems easy because, you know, we dialed it up because emergency. Well, the emergency's over. Dial it back. Couldn't do that. Just sort of got flatlined at that new higher level. And then, you know, we were supposed to, and then we were going to cut all kinds of things, but then they didn't cut that. Then we got the big, beautiful bill. And then there's these tariffs, and he's crowing about how the tariffs were awesome because they're bringing in some money. I'm still a little confused about where that money comes from. But our debt's now at $37 trillion, and I just wanted to point something out. This is from Wolf Street. Wolf Richter puts this chart out. You see that blue line down there? You see sort of the angle of that? That's pre-COVID. That's how fast our debt was growing. And it was growing pretty fast. But the slope of that blue arrow, Paul, is the pace. The steeper the slope, the faster the pace. Well, I took that same arrow and I just copy-pasted it a little higher so we can just sort of see that, you know, post-2020, we're just growing at a much faster pace. Debt is just... So not only are we not cutting the spending, but we've now enshrined this new faster pace of going deeper into debt. Mm-hmm. And yeah, that's disappointing to me. And by the way, Paul, Charlie again put this one out. So I've sort of highlighted there about 2014-ish, it was $18 trillion of debt. Now it's 37. It's about 10 years. I can do the math in my head. Anything that doubles over 10 years is growing at a 7% rate of yearly compounding. Mm-hmm. So that's where we're at. 7%. And it's probably a little steeper later on.
Absolutely incredible.
Our economy isn't growing 7%, not even on a nominal basis. So
no.
This just blows up sometime. It just breaks.
No, something breaks. And if they don't allow a recession with some deflation and the bankruptcies that are needed to clear out the economy and open up innovation so that we actually get new products. How long has it been since Apple introduced something innovative and new, right? I mean, when's the last time we've had a major, well, I mean, I know AI and the efficiency that's coming from there, but that's scalable across the board. It's max profitability. We're not growing. We need some creative destruction in there. We need some leadership to change. So that the capacity and creativity of the average individual can make us a better society across the board. Mm-hmm. But Chris, something's going to break at some point. Now we may have a short burst of deflation in the interim period. The best thing that can happen across the board would be deflation for everyone, because those who are prudent, who are paying attention to these details, can shelter themselves and turn it into opportunity.
Mm-hmm.
But the other side of that, if it breaks inflationary, that's going to be miserable for everyone. But the same strategies that are rewarding those that are speculating without knowing it right now are not going to win to the extent that they think they are. You're going to have a completely different investment strategy and adaptation to survive and protect your wealth on the other side of that. I mean, I wish I could remember the quote. I saw a quote when I was reading something yesterday about Lenin said that there's two ways to squeeze the bourgeoisie. Thank you, Chris. All right, I'll make fun of myself. I'm from North Georgia. Some of those are hard from time to time. But was taxation and inflation. And, you know, we've got the inflation part right now. At some point, the taxation is going to come along. And it's inflation is an equal opportunity punisher of everyone. At some point, you're only going to have that top 0.5% that's going to be benefiting from it at the expense of everyone else. So, you know, the best thing that we could see is some destruction in this cycle. And for those that are prudent and wise can prepare themselves and take advantage of it and hopefully wrestle away the reins of power so that we have good men that can take over instead of weak men who give in to short-term thinking and instant gratification, good men that can create good times again.
Well, did you see this then? Trump put this out, I guess it's yesterday at the time of this. Trillions of dollars are being taken in on tariffs. So I don't know where the trillions comes from, because apparently we took in $28 billion with a B for July. So, okay, a little hyperbole there. He says, tariffs have not caused inflation or any other problems for America other than massive amounts of cash pouring into our treasuries, coffers. And so, again, somebody's paying that money, right? Somebody's paying that. It's coming from a company. It's coming from a consumer. It's coming from somewhere. Trump's acting like it's free money that just, like, shows up at the border and nobody pays it, but it ends up in the coffers. So I'm not real clear on the mechanism of how he's thinking about that. But this idea... massive amounts of cash pouring into our coffers. Okay, so can we just talk about this real quick?
Oh, absolutely.
So July's deficit just came in. And it turns out that it was a $291 billion deficit, making it the second largest deficit for July on record. 2021 was the only one that was worse. I think you can see the trend here is getting worse. So we were supposed to get DOGE, spending cuts, tariffs are pouring in. If the tariffs are pouring in like crazy, and here they are, customs duties. It's one of the inputs here, $28 billion, okay? We're still clocking a $291 billion deficit, but I wanted to point something out that jumped out at me beyond that, Paul. We took in $131 billion in social insurance and retirement, and we paid $133 billion out in Social Security. Wow. And that doesn't include Medicare, right? Net interest at $92 billion annualizes out to $1.1 trillion. And then there's also income security down here. So actually, our social programs are now a net cash flow problem. They've always been a sort of a net positive, and they could spend it. But this is astonishing. $291 billion for a month.
That's incredible. That's incredible. Chris, what is income security? I know what Social Security is, but what is income security?
I'm going to have to look into that one.
Yeah, I'm curious to see what that one would be. But I had that same chart.
I assume that's just money they wire into Nancy Pelosi's stock trading account, I think.
That's good. I like that.
Just a guess. Yeah. I might be wrong on that one.
It brought to mind when I saw that chart over there about the second, you know, your bar chart on the right-hand side, the second largest on record. So I remember talking about July of last year, just how ridiculous the spending was. And we thought it was, you know, for political purposes going into the election to keep the economy up. And it's far worse now than what it was last year. And of course, exactly opposite of what Trump told us that he was going to do.
Yep. Well, The most important part about something like this is we're already spending at emergency levels and there isn't technically a recession yet. When one comes and is politically identified, these numbers blow up like crazy. This all just gets a lot worse because, of course, the political pressure is going to be there. First, recession hits, tax receipts fall, so the green side of this chart over there skinnies down. But there's pressures to actually increase outlays. You know, for stimmy checks or whatever, the stimulus or whatever. And we look at this, you know, here we are. So So, yes, this is worse than 24, 23, 22. This is the whole year to date. So we're up to July. The government's fiscal year ends on September 30th. So this chart goes from October to September. So we still got a couple months, right? We got August and September to sort of slap on here. But, yeah, we're going to probably be, this will be the third worst year of deficit spending in history.
You know, where's the trillions coming from? Because so far, the tariff revenues have peaked at about $20 billion per month, which is a $240 billion annualized rate. Mm-hmm. So I don't understand where he's, you know, can
in got the any, trillions
in yeah. any honest way get to trillions.
Nope. No, but wow. I'm concerned, Paul, that a lot of the government spending is actually somehow ending up in the hands of the Big Ten because, that you know, AI is existential. I know we're spending government money on it. We have to be. Because you can't just leave that to chance. And there's just not that much VC money floating around to support the scale and the pace of the hyperscaler buildouts of all these data centers. Da, da, da. So I think that's what we're throwing money at. This just compares three different years. Gold is 23, blue is 24, red is 25. So you can just sort of see month by month more easily that we're kind of outpacing all those other years pretty significantly. And again, that's without any sort of recession coming along to make things worse.
I had read some reports somewhere that the fiscal spending from the government heavily favors your largest companies in the S&P 500 at the expense of everyone else. I'll have to try to find that again, but I've read several reports that says that it just trickles back down into their profits.
Well, so I'm starting to get a kind of a weird feeling too, right? So I don't have a chart for or a headline for this, but you heard that, you know, NVIDIA was not allowed to sell chips to China. It's a national security issue. Their top H200, H100 chips can't do it. It's national security. You get them. But then Trump said, if you pay us 15% of the revenues, now you can. Like, so it wasn't an issue of national security. That's a shakedown, as far as I'm concerned, mm-hmm. right? Mm-hmm. I grokked it up. I tried to find, like, when has this happened in the past in U.S. history? I can't find an example of it. It's a very weird thing.
So I read an interesting article on that a couple maybe over the weekend, and they were just talking about that they couldn't find, whoever the author of the article was, could not find any period of time in history that had ever occurred before. And then he goes on, he said, let's just think about this from a long-term standpoint. I can't remember. If I remember correctly, he said the tariffs on the other, basically, S&P 490 was 39%, right? So if you're NVIDIA, you've got enough leverage and revenue right now to go in and negotiate with Trump. Okay. Mm-hmm. Somebody else, apparently, it was NVIDIA and AMD, wasn't it? Was it AMD that went in, Advanced Micro Devices that went in, and they came to that agreement as well? Well, what happens is now is every one of the companies in the S&P that has any international revenue going to have to go negotiate with the president for that? How efficient is that? And if you don't have the connections or the ability to go in there, or let's say you're blacklisted politically, this is something that bothers me. You shouldn't have that. I may disagree with the other side, but you have to have morality in any rule of law and business in there and have equal and fair standards, regardless whether you like somebody or not. Okay.
Agreed.
So what happens if you get blacklisted? Okay, everybody else, if you're favoring to the president, gets 15%, you can negotiate in. But what about you? You're going to be stuck at 39%? I mean, that's not the way our system should work. So I read the article two or three times, was absolutely blown away by the fact that this is a new precedent that we're setting, and I don't like it at all.
I don't either, but, you know, apparently we have a new precedent where you can bomb nuclear facilities now. As long as you're us.
Yeah.
But this, to add to, there's another data point. So the Trump pick for the new BLS commissioner has recently called for suspending the monthly jobs report. Now, as bad as the jobs report is, and I pick on it, and I have complaints, and I think it could be better, I would never say, let's do without it. It's one of the more important economic statistics that you need to sort of, you know, plan by and figure out what's happening by. I mean, this... I'm getting an odor off of this. This doesn't smell right to me here.
No, I didn't know that. I don't like that at all. I mean, hey, might as well take the gas gauge off of all of our cars now, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, I know it's slightly different, but if you can't gauge how labor is, how in the world can you gauge risk or manage as a business? You know, I mean, I know as a business, you got to make decisions regardless of what's taking place in the underlying economic force, but it helps you make decisions on deploying capital during certain periods of time when you can have those indicators and managing your portfolios, quite frankly. So that's just removing, that's taking any of your warning indicators off the dash of a car.
And as I said, since I saw it, Paul, you have to see it now too. I'm just telling you.
Oh my gosh. I believe you because I know you look at that. I'm just blown away. I'm absolutely blown away. What's the comedian says? It's a club and you're not a part of it.
Yeah, it's a big club and you ain't in it, said George Carlin. Yeah.
George Carlin, that's who it was. Boy, he was good. His stuff.
Yeah.
I mean, okay, well,
yeah,
I'm just blown away by that.
Well, in closing, there's just one other thing. I have to close with this and bring this up, and we can talk about it as long as necessary. But it Limitless, when I was speaking, I felt it relative to people who could have, should have been there. It was poorly attended because people don't understand this idea of peak oil, because a lot of press has been spent saying it's a stupid idea, it's a dumb idea, it's been debunked, it's a myth, it was wrong. So imagine our surprise when, you know, the EIA comes out and says, oh, no, the United States is peaking in oil. But then the biggest analytical firm out there called Rystad Energy, which is better, I think, because it's private. They have to be righter than the IEA, which has gone down this green fantasy thing and constantly is like trying to appease European politicians. Anyway, they've lost the plot. Paul, this comes out in Bloomberg just this week. And look at Rystad here. Global oil production on track for a massive shortfall. And here they have total producing wells in the dark blue. New infill wells in producing fields, so we kind of know what we can do there in the light blue. Under development is the lightest blue, and then we kind of hope we're going to get this purple stuff. That's stuff they kind of hope we're going to discover. But they compare that against oil demand, high demand, medium demand, or mean, and low. Under the worst case, under their best hopeful discovery cases, at best, we hit low oil demand, right? We're not going to keep up with the high oil demand after about 2030. This runs into severe trouble here by their stuff around the year 2032. That's like tomorrow in the scheme of these things. And it peaks out, you know, oil demand is currently right now at 104 million barrels a day. They say it doesn't get even to 120. I'll take the over under on that. Oil demand has always gone up by about 1.2 million barrels per day per year since my entire life. Some wiggles, but you average it out. I don't see any reason that would change. And part of the reason for that, Paul, is they're like, oh, but look at all these people moving off of internal combustion engines to electric vehicles. It's a dumb argument because we use oil for a lot of things besides putting into gas tanks. The second reason it's a dumb argument is that all the big, powerful nations, Paul, we consume about 13.8 barrels per capita, yeah? And the other 6.8 billion people in the world are currently at, like, literally one-tenth of that. They're burning just under 2 barrels per day per person. And so they want to catch up. They want to get off of a horse and get onto a scooter. They want to get off of their scooter, get on a motorcycle. They want to get off the motorcycle and get into a car. So, like, it doesn't really matter that Europe is going to get some Waymo driverless taxis. The whole world has been consuming oil my whole life, Paul. This is probably the most important. I mean, we have to have this conversation. We're just not having it yet. Their high case oil demand, I think, is, I'm going to call that base case, and it runs into problems relatively soon. And this is starting to become more widely known now.
Yeah, you've been warning people about it for quite some time. And, you know, and it just amazes me that there were so few people that came to your presentation at Limitless. And it also amazed me to look over and see just how intense George was paying attention and a few other individuals that are forward thinking in the room because your information was important, powerful. But I bet, Chris, if you'd have done a talk on AI and how you could profit and make gazillions of dollars in the next 12 months, you'd have had every single person at Limitless outside of one or two that would have been there. You know,
I know.
So, you know, there's going to be a lot of people that are going to really wish that they had attended your talk there and listened to the information that you're putting out, because that's powerful. You can't, you know, that's data.
Well, and I'm more of a contrarian investor than anything, and I like it that way. I like finding things that are out of favor. So I love that chart you showed of the relative proportion of energy stocks in the S&P. It's like a generationally low moment, which for me, I think that's where I prefer to get involved with things, is when nobody's paying attention to them.
Mm-hmm. And that's a point where you can start dollar cost averaging in. You can build into it. You can be patient. And, you know, and it's one thing to be patient on an investment that has all of the fundamental values there. I mean, all of us that are gold investors had to be ridiculously patient for quite some time. Now, my long-term tools gave us a sell signal in 2012, so I reduced my positions, started rebuilding back in 2016, but I was still dollar cost averaging in over that period of time, and specifically in silver, and it took some time to be rewarded. But now you look back, how many people are going, well, that looked like an easy investment to make. You've been well rewarded. It's number one performing asset, major asset class since the year 2000, comparison to S&P, NASDAQ, commodities, and what else. And I really look and see Buffett's underperforming like he did in 1999. I remember mm-hmm. these statistics because I've talked about it so much. In 1999, Buffett was down 19% approximately, and the S&P was up 20%. Now, if I remember the numbers correctly, Buffett lost 35% approximately of his investors during that period of time. And I remember Jim Cramer on CNBC talking about Warren Buffett didn't understand. He was too old school, that he needed to be replaced as a chair and chief investment officer of Berkshire Hathaway. And did you know there was a clip of that I found one time, but they copyright everything, so you can't show it if it's out there.
Yeah.
But, and then S&P goes down 47% from 2000 to 2003, and Buffett's up around 38, if I remember correctly. Well, I'm seeing the same thing take place right now. Your value stocks are getting sold left and right. The investors that are value investors are getting impatient. They're tired of listening to their brother-in-law and CNBC and everybody else get rich while they're sitting there, you know, kind of in the doldrums or just spinning in the mud. You got Buffett that's underperformed the S&P in the past 3 months at the worst period he's seen in some time. I think we're kind of just peak euphoria and people can't take it anymore. Momentum and AI and then global assets are chasing U.S. again, because that's what seems to be working, and people are convincing themselves that it is different this time, even though they're too scared to say it out loud. And we need to, you know, there are times we should do exactly opposite of what we feel like doing. And when the temptation is to go, you know, chase all of these AI names out there right now, we really should be looking to energy and at a minimum dollar cost averaging in there.
A couple things here, and thanks for putting it that way. I know the Fed's going to cut rates because that's what they do, and my trust is based on repeated consistent actions. They've repeatedly and consistently shown that's who they are, and so an idea I want to leave people with here today is this, which is when I got into gold and silver, they were super hated, right? So gold was about 300 an ounce. I remember my first silver purchase, it was $4.53 an ounce, and
wow.
That was 2001. And it was just like, people are like, you're buying what? Like, it was just the stupidest thing ever, right? But it kind of made sense to me. And then since then, people are like, oh, you know, stocks, all this, that. Check this out. 50 years of gold in stocks. 50 years. So if you'd said, is that a long enough investment horizon? 50 years.
That's a long one.
Yeah. Let me just put this over a tiny bit so we can see it together. Yeah. So if you had gotten into gold and stocks at the same time when gold was finally 1973, you could buy it again. So if you'd gotten into it, yeah? Well, you've actually done a little bit better over those 50 years. Same thing if you bought gold in 2000 when stocks were kind of high and gold was low. You've pretty much outperformed it. So it's, I'm not saying put everything in there, but it's kind of like a no fuss, no muss. It's the thing, Paul, that I like because I don't have to worry. I don't lose any sleep because I have my gold. You know, sometimes people call me up, oh, Chris, it fell $100 or it's up. I actually don't pay attention to that anymore. I care about how many ounces I have. That's my own, like, that's the only measure that actually matters in this story. But it just, this whole story is actually just a story of money printing. It's money printing. So how do you avoid money printing? Well, lots of different ways, but this is one of them, you know.
That's one of them.
And they're going to print more.
They're going to print more. Well, how else are they going to? If our debt's growing at 7%, our economy is not growing that fast, then they're all in, right? Like, they don't have any other option outside of print or go through the pain in the short run of letting the markets go through what needs to be done to reset the system. But, you know, Trump's like, what was it? For 2 weeks? 2 weeks, I think he said. Hey, we got to experience some short-term pain for long-term gain. Maybe it was a little longer than 2 or 3 weeks, but it was just a little bit of a blip.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, what's that? It's like, you know, I watch my boys wrestle around until one of them cries uncle, and, you know, and one of them will nearly get choked out before they'll tap out. And all somebody did was just reach up and touch Trump. And then all of a sudden, forget the short-term pain for long-term gain. It's back to, let's just see if we can reach escape velocity. And I just don't see how without something breaking, whether it's our currency, which is going to cause a lot of pain, right? I mean, that's a major advantage that we have with strong purchasing power around the world. And at some point, I know a lot of the currencies are pegged to the dollar. So if they're all going down the same, but at some point, somebody's going to walk away and take advantage of that. And the ones that are most likely at this point, I know we talked about it briefly, but the BRICS are still moving forward with the unit. BRICS pay. They're consistently taking steps in that direction. The Shanghai Gold Exchange, are their prices still better than what they are here now? And then they haven't changed the fact that the day comes that they roll out the unit, that it's going to be 40% backed by gold. So they're working a long-term plan, and we seem to be working on instant gratification here in the short run.
Well, if this recession hits the way I think it's going to, I think this is going to be a rough fall for stocks. So enjoy your August, everybody, you know. Things just seem to just sort of be floating upwards at this point in time, but sooner or later, reality has a way of coming in. I'm a little worried, Paul, that Wall Street insiders have access to the same information and more, and they're just distributing as much as they can right now.
Right. I'm concerned about that, too. And private equities, advertising blitz, their lobbying power to open up 401ks for private equity investments. I mean, a large majority of them are levered to the hilt. I mean, that's the reason why they bought up everyone to try to get into monopolistic situations. So now they need an exit, right?
Mm-hmm.
And the average individual has the capacity, and a lot of average investor has the capacity because their minimum purchases are down to the point that they can get in there. And that concerns me greatly.
Yep.
So
agreed.
One thing I want to share with people out there is I know I've said this, and if I look like a fool for the next 6 months, that's fine. You know, if you're choosing the path of wisdom, you're going to look foolish in the short run, but wisdom's always going to rise to the top in the long term, okay? So this is a period of time. Look, if you're stressed about your situation, you're in too much debt, now's a time where you can make some adaptations to maneuver around and get yourself in a more resilient position. Hey, what's the worst? Missed opportunity is not going to wipe you out. But if you're over-levered and it's not completely different this time and we do have some deflation, I'm hearing a lot of individuals are having a hard time replacing jobs. I know some individuals that are in jobs that they're stuck. They've been able to bounce around before. And the job market is not as strong as what it has been in the past. If this is a slowly and then suddenly fall off in the economy, we're not going to have a real good picture until we get into October, November anyway, because of all the potential front running of the tariffs, and then they backed off and then they come back again and potential front running. So I know corporate profits have looked far better than anybody expected. the economy in general, even though we've got all kinds of recessionary indicators, has been steadier, but it's still a decline. We're seeing that. So risk is high right now. This is not a time to gamble. This is a time to be prudent. Bible tells us twice in Proverbs that the prudent foresee danger and hide themselves. So you know, seriously consider, you know, look at fundamental value of your investments. Is it priced to perfection? If so, sweep some off the top. You know, even in the crypto space, right? There's all kinds of arguments there. You go back and look, there's been massive declines that have occurred. And I'm, you know, I don't think it's going to go through a recession unscathed. Gold didn't go through unscathed in 2000 to 2008. You know, it went from 1,000 to 600 an ounce, I think it was, wasn't it, Chris? It was 40%, 650, somewhere around there. So seriously, consider beefing up your emergency funds. You know, get yourself in a position, if you're choosing to be passive, that you can ride out the storm. Because if we do have a recession that's worse than what you think it's going to be, the last thing you want to do is be forced to sell, you know, companies that are going to be there in the long run when they reset their valuations back to where they should be. And then they finally get cheap where the most of us are maybe stepping in there and buying them at that point. Don't be in a position where you're forced to sell to those people who were prudent ahead of time. So just make yourself as resilient as possible, beef up your emergency funds and, you know, be patient, think long-term, be an investor. Don't be a speculator.
Very well said. So if anybody out there listening right now would want to talk with Paul and his team, please go to peakfinancialinvesting.com. Very simple form to fill out. Somebody from Paul's team will reach out, schedule a meeting within 48 business hours. And I think everybody, Paul, deserves to have a chance to go through that planning process with you and talk about their situation. And most importantly, whether you work with Paul or not, please, this is a time to exercise a risk-managed approach, not a passive approach. It's really important. We just laid out everything to say, wow, most expensive stock market ever, and a lot of warning indicators. What could go wrong? The answer is, well, actually, what could go right would be the right question. You know, and the answer is, well, everything has to go perfectly right for this not to be exactly how it's been many, many times in history. So unless something's really different this time, which it never is, you should expect that there's going to be some turbulence. We'd like you to be prepared and ready for that. So with that, Paul, thanks so much for your time today.
Oh, it's my honor, Chris. Always a pleasure.